Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
I'm Stephen.
And this is the snot-fueled New Statesman podcast. I'd like to start off by thanking those of you who listened last week will have heard that Stephen's cold. They will now be hearing Stephen's cold again, which has now lodged itself in my sinuses. So it's pretty much just a misery. It's just a misery-filled catacomb in the New Statesman podcast this morning.
I mean, I'm actually...
It's the afternoon. Yeah, oh,
I'm actually feeling all right, to be honest. I've still got a cough, but... I think I'm sounding less nasal. I mean, it's a low bass, right?
Yeah, you don't sound nasal at all now.
But there's like my usual level of nasal, and there's the, oh, wow, Stephen, you're bunged up level of nasal. And
yeah,
I'm just saying...
I'd say you're at maybe like 5.5 AORDs at the moment.
Yeah, it's the thing. I'm coming back down to, you know, the usual
resting
one.
Baseline.
Yeah, my baseline nasalness.
Talking of people who weren't ill and were talking without being nasal, Jeremy Corbyn. We just watched his speech. I confess I had a conversation and missed 10 minutes that appeared to be close to the end, but I don't feel like I missed anything. So give me your snap judgment on it.
I thought it was far and away the best speech in terms of delivery than I've heard Corbyn give. I know, obviously, I've heard a slightly dispiriting amount when I think about the total percentage of my life over the last 2 years of being Corbyn speeches. But, yeah, kind of when I think about the speeches I saw him give at the various regional receptions, then I did my kind of level, kind of combination of, come on, please do me a solid, and then, do you know who I am? I'd like to clarify, I have never, ever said, do you know who I am, to try and get him to.
Oh, you have said, do me a solid. That's alarming. I feel the same thing about that. I watched one of the rallies, I can't remember, it was in Kilburn. It was one in Kilburn on Facebook Live from the start, and it would... I tell you what, it would have definitely benefited from an auto cue, because there was that rambly bit at the beginning about the media hate us, or, yeah, we're against us. And I know that this is a different sort of type of speech, a much more formal one, but actually the formality and the structure of it, I think it reminded people why most people don't just speak off the cuff, right? It was just better. It had a start, a middle, and an end, and it had some jokes in it. There was one joke about, you know, the hall's packed, but not Virgin Trains would say there are 880 seats left. You know, it had some decent policy bits as well.
Yeah, and it had a lot of what a lot of, as I've bored listeners on before, the reason why I prefer the word Corbyn skeptic is it captures the breadth of that opposition. And in terms of the winnable Corbyn skeptic chunk, about 100 of the PLP, and probably, I reckon, maybe 20% of the total membership. And actually, I reckon there's a level of, oh, I like the ideas, but I'm not sure about some other things, than I think voted for Corbyn because they were so unimpressed by Owen Smith. And I think in terms of that constituency, it was a speech which is exactly what those people have wanted. It used kind of relatively accessible language to talk about left-wing policy. It did things like tried to reframe paying taxes in terms of patriotism and doing the right thing for little businesses which do the right thing, etc., etc. It had a definitive position on immigration.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most striking things about it. I mean, there are two ways that you can go with immigration, and that's what we've seen at Labour Party conference. You've seen the sort of Rachel Reeves, Chukwuemeka, Emma Reynolds wing of the party, Stephen Kinnock as well, saying, you know, freedom of movement is over.
Although you still have like Liz Kendall, Pat McFadden, Wes Streeting, who are still like, no surrender, we've got to stay in the single market no matter what.
Yeah, but that's the, you know, that's where the big divide is. Or I mean, so you can take two approaches to the fact that, you know, the Brexit is a fact and we're not going to indulge this sort of Hannan-esque rewriting of it being about sovereignty, when I think, you know, a huge number of voters were motivated by what they thought was a referendum on border control. So you can either say, well, look, we have to acknowledge that, or you have to say that's a misconception and we're going to fight it. And Corbyn's clearly gone the other way. I mean, let's face it, that speech had a lot of debt to Owen Jones in it, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It was...
There was a lot of that, you know, it's not Polish nurses that brought down the financial crisis, it's the bankers kind of stuff. I mean, it felt very Owen-y.
It was very Owen-y, which was striking, because obviously he is very much not, you know...
He's not inside... He's sort of semi in the tent, isn't he? He's not really inside the tent, but clearly they
read him. He's kind of like the designated smoker loitering outside of the tent while someone else is trying to do the barbecue inside, going, you shouldn't be doing that inside the tent, take it outside, and has in some ways been a slightly peripheral figure. But yeah, it was very much kind of what he's been calling for. I mean, the thing I find interesting...
Less what Paul Mason has been calling for, but this is the thing I think is kind of interesting if we navigate it through the kind of, you know, it wasn't a, I'm going to deselect them all, come with me or it's the end of your careers, toots, kind of...
It also didn't have what if you wanted to, because the interesting thing about putting Labour on an election footing, and I mean, yeah, it would be fascinating to know how many drafts it went through. There were, one of the things which happened at this conference was that the leadership lost its majority on the NEC.
Which means that there in future rule changes, like those endless rows we had over the summer about whether or not Corbyn should automatically go on the ballot, those things are harder for him in future.
Well, yeah, it's now hung because the Corbyn sceptics decided that it was worth more to hold the chair.
Yeah.
And to lose their majority of one, right? So they had two options. You either elect a chair who's a pro-Corbynite, and then you've actually got a fairly stable majority, or you go, right, we give it up. In their view, and then as a Labour rules geek, my instinct is they're right, is that you are better off with the chair because you can then rule on procedures, whether or not something's out of order, etc., etc. Whereas if you have a situation where the other lot have the chair and you have a majority of two,
you can vote against things that they put up. Yeah, but they run the show. And also the Labour, the Welsh Labour, I don't know, is that going to be Carwyn Jones is going to definitely... I know Kezia Dugdale's taken the seat for Scottish Labour, but there is a possibility that Carwyn Jones can nominate someone else, or he can nominate himself. Do we know which that will be yet?
So I spoke to Karen at some length on the Monday. I visit Wales a fair amount, both for here and because my partner, who I'm contractually obligated to mention at least once every podcast, went to university in Wales. He is going to appoint someone because he has to run the government.
He's got stuff to do.
Yeah, Karen doesn't have the time for these eight-hour meetings.
Is that how I should be pronouncing it?
I'm not sure. I've only started pronouncing it Karen because a lot of my Welsh Labour sources do, and I wasn't sure if they were discreetly trying to correct me.
Okay.
Because the problem is, because Welsh people are so nice, right? Anyone else would just be like, Stephen, what are you doing? It's not called Carwyn. He's not a competition. But instead, they just kind of very softly say Karen, and you're like, I think maybe that's that. But they also have they're nice, but they also have like a sense of humour where they try and trick you. Wow, I'm sounding like John Redwood. and I'm worried that they also might have been a thing where they're like, let's see if we can persuade Stephen
to call him Karen.
Yeah.
Ask listeners to write in and definitively, if we have Welsh listeners, if Stephen hasn't in previous podcasts insulted you away, then please do tell us whether or not we're mangling the Welsh First Minister's name.
But he was integral to it passing, partly because he has been... So one of the slight difficult things about covering the Labour Party is it has a democratic...
It makes you want to die.
..constitution, but not a democratic culture, right? So the Welsh and Scottish parties have been asking for this for a long time. It was, I mean, not a big part of Karen's bid to become leader, but, you know, it was one of the items. And what has happened, yes, this is undeniably true, is a chunk of the English party has decided it is pro that...
In order
it knocks out Corbyn's majority. However... One of the things I think that the Leader's Office got wrong in its approach to opposing it is that they alienated a lot of Welsh people who had voted for Corbyn and a lot of the kind of because Owen Smith very much, he was the candidate of part of the Welsh establishment, but there were also people in the Welsh establishment who really wanted him to lose. And I think a lot of those people felt, you know, so in the meeting, obviously, Karen can attend, but he cannot vote. And when Jeremy tried to deny it, he said, this has been delayed for 2 years. You've kept us waiting for years. This has to happen now. The Welsh Unite, there was a bit of a revolt in the Welsh Unite section. So I think that we might look back if the Corbynite position on the NEC further erodes in the union section and think, oh, maybe actually if they had found a way to lose with grace, which is very much where some of Team Corbyn are on some other issues. So,
okay, but before we come to, I mean, undoubtedly thrilling though the composition of the NEC is, and it is. Let's just quickly whiz through the recap of the rest of the conference.
Sorry,
for anybody.
I was getting a bit anoraky there, wasn't I?
I felt that you might start talking about standing orders, and I thought I'd have them stage an intervention. Conference started on Sunday, of course. Well, it started. There was women's conference on Saturday and the re-announcement of His Glorious Jesuness' ascension back to the throne, re-ascension to the throne. Sunday was mostly notable for the New Statesman Party, which a good time was had by all. And then Monday we...
Not quite by all. Matt Tawley, who writes the second best morning email, the first best is of course mine, which you can find and subscribe to by searching Stephen Bush Morning Call. No, Stagger's Morning Call. I'm an idiot. Stagger's Morning Call. Just...
I think your name's in it too, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
People will find it. But let's finish with calling out in our safe space. He was very mean and said that our booze ran out very quickly. To which the only obvious answer is, well, you shouldn't have drunk so much.
Well, one, you shouldn't have drunk so much, but also, you know, where's my invite to the Times party?
Where's my puppy?
Maybe it's ended up in my spam folder, like Redbox does from time to time.
Oh, you did! It's fine, we'll get away with it. I mean, we got away with all the Fraser nastiness that you've previously advanced. So it's, I feel our listeners are tight. They're not going to dob us in. So Monday we had Emily Thornberry's speech and John McDonnell, which was a really interesting speech because it was Theresa May-like. John McDonnell and Theresa May might not agree on very many things, but they do agree that, and I'm going to use a word that I think is used very sloppily, but here probably is actually the right one to use, the era of neoliberalism is over. The era of free market fundamentalism, of not feeling that you can interfere in globalisation, is over. And he talked about, you know, wanting a state that wasn't afraid to intervene, about the winds of change we're now blowing against globalisation. Talked about, you know, something like the Chinese steel crisis happening on his watch. You know, he called out those governments that didn't protect themselves against the Chinese dumping cheap steel on the international markets. So a rare moment of kind of unity between the Tories and the and Labour on that one. Then Sadiq's speech, which I didn't watch, but I think that the only thing you, if anyone asks you about it, the only thing apparently you have to say is he said the word power a lot, you know. Did he say anything else that wasn't the word power that was interesting that I missed?
No, he basically went...
Holla, winner, winner.
Yeah. That was the other kind of... The other side of the imaging is one of the things that Karen has loved doing for a long time is he's loved going, hey, do you know which bit of the Labour Party still runs something? This bit, this guy, bring it here. And now Sadiq is running around doing exactly like, that.
What's got two thumbs and governs London? This guy.
And you can see that it kind of, obviously he's, you know, very glad that Labour are winning again outside of Wales, but you can feel that it also kind of tweaks him a little bit.
And then we had also Tom Watson's speech in which he said basically something, I think, which was interesting that this went down quite so well with the activists in the hall. You know, we shouldn't have spent the last 6 years slagging off our record. And I think that's a, you know, that was a debate that was happening even, you know, as it was, as that last parliament was going on,
okay,
right?
Okay, right. So I'm going to say I have a couple of choice observations about Tom Watson's speech. I was very unhappy that I had foolishly not taken my copy of Ed Balls's book. Right, and or indeed...
Okay, just do you want to... Can I interrupt you and say, I saw Tom Watson outside the Pullman Hotel late at night on Sunday, and I swear that I saw Ed Balls as well. And apparently Ed Balls was not at conference due to his intensive Strictly training regime, which means either there is like someone who looks exactly like Ed Balls, or your cold made me hallucinate Ed Balls.
I think it's more likely, seeing as a lot of people on Labour's old right look very similar... That,
it was another burly man.
They're all fairly burly, aren't they? Right. It feels more likely than it was another burly man than I've given you an hallucinating cold.
The worst thing is to hallucinate the nipples. I thought he looked very good. I really liked the thing that he wore on Strictly. Do you see he wore the suit, but it was like a suit but sequined.
I'm not actually watching Strictly.
Oh, right. Well, I bet you're probably watching, you know, you're listening to Radio 3, probably. Because you don't understand, you know, in your Islington, in your North London.
My North London
granola
townhouse.
But yeah,
anyway.
So going choice observations. Go cuss out Tom Watson.
Tom Watson says, I don't understand why we spent 6 years slagging off our record in government. Tom Watson not only voted for the candidate who ran on that platform in 2010, Ed Miliband, there are a couple of people who can honestly say, you can honestly say they are to blame for Ed Miliband becoming Labour leader. One, of course, is David Miliband for not having the wit to do a deal with Ed Balls, and the only deal he'd have done would have been to offer Ed Balls the thing he'd have needed to offer him anyway, the job of Shadow Chancellor. So well done, David Miliband. Ed Miliband, of course, for running. Len McCluskey and Paul Kenny for fixing...
funding him.
...the GMB and Unite arrangement. So they've... And, actually, David Miliband, again, for insulting and irritating so many Labour MPs. And lastly, Tom Watson, the crucial group were people who voted Ed Balls 1, Ed Miliband 2, and there was an informal arrangement organised by Tom Watson to do that, to stop David Miliband becoming leader of the Labour Party. And we also shouldn't forget, you know, I've called out Yvette for this in the past, Tom Watson was another one of the people who wanted to put Corbyn on the ballot to hurt Andy Burnham, right? Now, it is great...
They succeeded.
Yeah, it's true.
Admirably.
It is great that these people are now trying to stand up for a type of Labour Party that they agree with. However, they ultimately did... Their whole political strategy was to demonise other people who did that and have this idea that as long as you controlled the shortlist, it would be fine. And then they forgot that fundamental truth. And now they're in a mess, right? So every time everyone goes, oh, brilliant, Tom Watson going, how did we get here? You, Tom, you're how we got here.
Good. That was the second angriest that I've seen a man sitting next to me after Chukwuemeka, who was also pretty angry, had sat next to me at an IPPR fringe on Britain and Europe, and then went on a massive rant, and I can say that it was a rant because he concluded it by going, I'm sorry, I've just had a massive rant, about the fact that Brexit wasn't discussed on the conference floor. And it wasn't really massively addressed, I don't think, in Corbyn's speech. There was some gesture towards freedom of movement and how he wouldn't be one of the people who was kind of calling for curbs on that. But that did seem a strange kind of omission from... Here's my takeaway on the speech. I thought the speech was good. I thought it was certainly the best speech I've ever seen him given. It was pretty competent and had some funny lines in it. But it felt like the last swallow of summer, I don't think that is a metaphor. But you know what I mean? It felt like this is my last time in my happy place talking to people, feeling the love and saying the things that I need to say before I've got to go back to the mean old real world outside. And that just felt a tiny bit self-indulgent. If it had been in a situation where the members were all really unhappy and the primary job of that speech was to cheer up the members, that would have been a great speech to have given. But though,
I mean, the members are all really unhappy.
But I don't think that speech will have... Are they?
Yes, actually. I think on the whole, the thing I found interesting... is so the World Transformed, which was a momentous event, was significantly sparkier. It was very surreal because it certainly reminded me of a certain type of one of my mother's friends in the early 90s. It was a bit sparkier. But actually, the people around the leader were a bit flat because they've just fought an election. Activists on both sides are a bit exhausted, I think, because of the feeling it was a foregone conclusion that had gone on for a very long time. And
MPs, I found, generally there was a sort of sense of, even among people who were pretty opposed to Corbyn's leadership, of just, you know, weariness and acceptance of defeat. But, you know, normal people seemed quite G'd up. But then maybe
you're just more of a draw than I am.
This is my electrifying effect on the fringe discussion about trade rules after Brexit. My worry is we're going to lapse into what I think of now as Nick Clegg syndrome, where you accept all the things that are, you know, obvious downsides of a candidate or their position. But because they're boring to kind of say, well, those things are still true, everybody tries to desperately seek a sort of slightly different narrative and be counterintuitive. And I think we'll go through a phase where people will kind of go like, oh, he's done really well. Oh, this is really good. Oh, this is really good. And actually kind of it becomes sort of boring and conventional wisdom to say the things that are, you know, boring and conventional wisdom.
You can see the lobby already doing this, yeah, with Nick Robinson's.
We should actually think really seriously about whether or not he can become Prime Minister. And we should do that because he is the candidate to be, you know, he's the leader of the major opposition party, and we should give his policies and positions the scrutiny that they deserve, as if he's going to be, you know, he's one of only two people who could end up in Downing Street after the next election.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as I've said before on the podcast, and one of the things I think lots of journalists, myself included, got wrong was we didn't cover the Tory manifesto in 2015. As a document that was going to form the basis for a single-party government.
Yeah, and exactly the same thing. There might be some ruinous version of Brexit. We might have some terrible recession, and actually something happens, does a deal with the SNP, and it could, you know, it's not... Lots and lots of things are the ifs, if. But it's, you know, it still doesn't mean that you can just kind of go, oh, that's boring, I wonder. But I just don't like this sort of constant, like, we're bored of saying this thing, so let's say a new thing, which seems to be somewhat, so often how political journalism works.
Yeah, I agree. Although I also think that you've sort of got to assess people by the targets they've set themselves, as it were, right? So to take, say, yeah, so for example, was Labour's 2010 election campaign good or bad? Well, it was excellent, because they knew that they were going to lose, and their aim was to do better than, yeah, it was to do better by having as an efficient a vote share as possible. And their aim in Scotland was to avoid a repeat of what was already happening in Holyrood in Westminster. And they achieved those outcomes. Whereas to take the 2015 example, right, what were they aiming for in Scotland? They were aiming to hold 12, right? Mm. So they
failed pretty fairly
miserably. They failed by, you know, quite a very high percentage. I'm still seeing too coldly to work out what percentage.
Okay, that makes sense. I think that's... But so Corbyn's target that he set himself was 1 million Labour members, right? There's this idea about he wants to build them. And that's the rubric that maybe we should judge him by. I think the new shadow cabinet will be interesting. I think that Andy Burnham has now departed, or will depart, ready for his run at the Manchester mayor election. I'm sure Angela Rayner will get a big promotion. They've been pushing her very heavily as she's currently at schools. She's got a really interesting life story. She's quite a straightforward talker. I think she's got a lot of promise. And then there's an opportunity to bring back, you know, a few of the... I think Jonathan Reynolds has talked about the fact that he would serve again.
Yeah.
I know your your friend of mine, Charlie Faulkner, is, I think, probably would... Who seemed to be the totally carefree, you know, like little Simba running around Westminster, but inexplicably is the sort of last Blairite standing, but I'm sure would go back in.
Oh, yeah, no, Charlie would definitely go back into the shadow cabinet. I mean, I think the thing is, so there are a couple of there are sort of three types of people who will return, right? There are people who have got tricky selection battles. There's some overlap between these three groups. There are people who didn't think it would work, but sort of felt they had to, because, you know, the thing it's always important not to forget is it's also like any other workplace. If someone's mates are doing something, people are more inclined to be like, well, even if I'm not sure if this is going to work, right? You know,
you should muck in.
Yeah, you should kind of muck in and try and help your mates out.
And the third group?
And then the third group is people who really, really want to be shadow ministers. There are just some people who just really like being, you know, the shadow minister or whatever. Or there is one of the advantages of the fact that it is going to be a bit of a cobbled together thing, Robbie, is that there are people who really care about one policy brief, right?
Well, I was going to say someone like Lucy Powell's in an interesting spot, because if, as I expect, Angela Rayner gets moved into maybe a higher profile role, then actually the obvious choice really is Lucy Powell, who's done really good work on grammar schools, is clearly still really passionate about that brief. I don't know whether or not she would go back in, but that is a kind of... I mean, you know, when you say people who just really want to be ministers, it sounds quite craven, but you're right that sometimes it's people who just like being important, and sometimes it's people who... There is one policy area that they really, really care about.
Yeah, so Chiomwura is a good example. I don't really know what the situation... I know that for a while John Trickett wanted to do slightly less because he's, you know... getting on in years, etc., etc. But I'm not sure what the situation with that at the moment is, in truth. But if Shadow Biz became up for grabs, that's always been Chiyomura's dream job. And so there are people who go, culture is their dream job, etc., etc. And so you can kind of see how that will work. And also, that way they don't have to talk about any of the policy issues they disagree with him on. So you'll kind of... So that those will be the three groups and we'll
okay. Well, that's who knows when the Shadow Cabinet re-elections reshuffle will come. I am at the edge of my seat, and of course next week we'll be back to talk about Tory Party conference. Hopefully, both of us will be better again.
We can but hope.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can get this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
And now for a segment called You Ask Us, in which you ask us. You can always get hold of us on Twitter. I'm at Helen Lewis, Stephen is at Stephen KB, or on Stephen's Facebook fan page, where you can also post, I don't know, GIFs and fan fiction. This week, I have a question from Satish Berry, who says, Hi Helen, hi Stephen. I was wondering whether you believe Labour should focus its energy on ensuring there is a referendum on whatever Brexit deal Theresa May obtains, or whether they should accept that we're leaving the EU and focus on ensuring it is as soft as possible, so retaining access to the single market and free movement, along with the holy grail of determining the curvatures of our own bananas. So, yeah, let's have a chat about that. I have a strong opinion on this. My strong opinion is, people have voted in a referendum at a time when trust is very low in politics. And if you go, lol, joke, we weren't really actually going to leave the European Union, that would be crazy, then I think that's only likely to poison the well of democratic debate further. I can see, if I were the Lib Dems, I would pursue the Lib Dem strategy of we're going to referendum on the deal, and then the two options on the ballot paper are take this deal or stay in the European Union. I think that for their supporters, you know, the percentage of supporters they want to get to, you know, they're not, there's no, I can't, are they Eurosceptic Lib Dems? Is there such a thing? You know, they're just, it makes sense, right? There are people who are Remainers who are angry about Remainer not reconciled to the result, and they can pick up those people. For Labour, who want to try and get to, you know, ooh, remember when we talked about the 35% strategy, like that was a really low bar for Labour. You know, they want to get to 35-40%, then they do need to be seen to accept the referendum decision. That's my own personal feeling.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm going to be dull and wonkish.
Yeah.
Which is going to be a shock to our listeners. The difficulty is so I think that the advantage of a second referendum on the deal is that the gulf between what was promised and what people voted on and what emerges will be fairly large. And its long-term effect on British power and influence and general prosperity will also be fairly large. My instinct is that a second referendum would be lost, partly because it's not clear to me who would lead the other campaign. We now have a Labour leadership which is explicitly committed to leaving the single market.
They want to retain access to the single market, which is this new thing that people who don't really understand the concept of the single market say, right? Everyone in the whole world has got access to the single market.
Yeah, it's like the new thing about reforming free movement when we were still in the EU. It's like, okay, well...
You don't understand how that works.
But my feeling is that people will be very angry about that. And I think you know, who do people tend to take their anger out on? Sometimes the establishment... The worrying thing is in lots of places where people will be angriest, the establishment is the Labour Party. So that is less helpful. But actually the depressing thing is that's the best case scenario. People often tend to blame ethnic, social and cultural minorities. So I'm kind of in favour of a second referendum on the deal so actually people have been bound into it.
I think but then you and I have got our theory about the early election, which now seems to be kind of conventional wisdom at Labour Party conference, right?
Yeah.
And you make the deal part of your manifesto. You know, you say, well, actually, we're going to go for this. And then you put it, it's in the Tory Party manifesto, and then you get a majority on that. And that's essentially then the same as a second referendum. except that there's no option for people to vote for the bit that involves staying in. Actually, weirdly, I was on a panel at a conference with Anil Menon, who's a professor at King's College London in European politics, who said one of the things that it's unfair on the rest of the EU to do this hokey-cokey, actually. That's one of the big reasons about saying you can't say that you're going to leave and then go, actually, we're coming back in again. Because that is, you know, if we care at all about the rest of the EU, we should not try to destabilise it like that.
But also, once the thing is the deal happens once you've triggered Article 50. Once you've triggered Article 50, you've left, right? It's kind of a bit like saying, should I jump out of my window and then when I hit the ground have a vote about whether or not to break both my legs? Actually, the moment you're in the air, the floor is calling.
But I think that I said this at our live podcast on Saturday, and I will say it again there on freedom of movement. I don't know what I think.
By the way, can I just say, having chaired a lot of panels at Labour Party conference, The audience at our live podcast has proved my theory that the two loveliest groups of people in the world are people with BT internet email addresses and our podcast listeners.
Oh, that's nice. What about, you get a lot of these writing into our letters pages, people with BT internet addresses that are theirs and their partners.
Yeah, they are. They're always like...
Jeff and Marjorie at btinternet.com always fills me with a kind of, oh, thank you, Jeff and Marjorie share everything. Yeah. I think the problem is that any discussion of immigration is just gets into this toxic place straight away, where half the people are saying, well, no one will let us talk about immigration, despite the fact we talk about immigration all the time. The other half instantly think that, you know, it's just a capitulation to a right-wing tabloid agenda to have anything, like to have basically any borders at all, right? I think it's really hard to have a sensible discussion in the middle of that.
But this is actually something that I do blame the Parliamentary Labour Party for, right? So one fringe I did was with... was with the excellent Roger Scully from the University of Cardiff, and they and the University of Edinburgh have done a study of voters' attitudes towards Englishness, immigration, devolution, the general settlement, how they feel about the various parties. It is really grim reading for the Labour Party. And, you know, as I said in my response, I said the difficulty is I can work out what Labour would need to do to win, but unfortunately I don't want to do any of those things, and I'm kind of stuck at that point.
Yeah, but, well, I wrote this column about nationalism, and I put it out, you know, on Twitter today saying, you know, if there is this gap in British politics for someone who talks to English people about English nationalism, you know, if Labour won't fill it, someone else will. And people took that as an endorsement of kind of English nationalism as a force. And you're like, well, it's not, but it's clearly, there is something, you know, the Labour Party's got to kind of either... has got to grapple with that in some way, right? Otherwise it's just going to lose those people to UKIP, which is not an outcome that presumably the Labour Party wants either.
Well, yeah, I mean, but the thing I found really interesting is because I then said, you know, my overwhelming impression from these academics was, and I said, you know, clearly Corbynomics, as it were, can win an election. It just has to be coupled with a series of policy stances which I find fairly revolting. Incredible scepticism towards immigration. You know, I mean, actually, I'm really fine with being authoritarian about crime, to be honest. But you know, and you know, and kind of wrapping itself in the English flag, which again, I'm sort of fine with. And then you know, punitive language at least on welfare, which I'm really not okay with. But that kind of is one of the things where it's quite clear from the numbers. And we had a really interesting conversation where, you know, all of the actors, when you show them the data, acknowledge the problem. We all kind of acknowledge it's really difficult to work a path forward. But, you know, when Harriet decided to send that signal that Labour was a soft touch on welfare...
This is when she decided to abstain on the second...
On the second read. Well, that was the first time... You can't not give people all of the information you have when you make a decision and necessarily expect them... to accept that you've made the decision for the right reason. So I think some of the reasons why Labour is where it is that, you know, if you treat people like children, then they scream and
throw their plates of dinner around the place. Yeah, I think that, I think Europe is a particularly tricky issue because you've got a PLP that is much more Europhiliac than the leadership, and you've also got a membership that is, you know, broadly very pro-European, right? So it's one of those ones where Corbyn's records so far of being a much more skillful political operator than people give him credit for, at least within the arena of left-wing politics, you just imagine he's just not going to say anything.
I don't know. So I think the thing is now we've left, and in terms of the economic agenda, not being in the single market means you can be much more interventionist from an economic perspective. So I would be surprised. They also have a mandate for it. I mean, they had a mandate last time for it. I'm afraid this is just where I still just do lose patience with this argument, right? I'm willing to accept that some people, including Danny Daly, who asked a very good question at our podcast, which we will eventually be able to put a recorded version of the live version once King's Place sends it over to us. I'm willing to accept that people can be both pro-European and vote for Corbyn, but they have made a decision that their opposition to
They like Corbyn more than they like Europe.
Because he won't be for the European project. And you know that is life, right? That people make those trade-offs all the time, you know.
Yeah.
Lots of businesses voted for a dangerous referendum on the EU because they were worried about Ed Miliband's mansion tax, and well, that's worked out great for them.
I know, I do laugh a bit when I look at the FT front page and I see businesses complaining about, you know, about the impact of Brexit on them, and you think, yeah, it's really weird now just to see a Tory party that's picking a fight with business. That's, you know, after 5 years of being told that Labour were, you know, terrible danger because they crashed the economy. Anyway, that's us devolving into one of our pretty well-worn rants there. So maybe that's a good point to wrap up. But thank you for your question, and please do send us any more that you have.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by Helen Lewis and me, Stephen Bush, and produced by India Bork. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.